Anyway, 'cause nowadays a woman can't even go out in the middle of the day. No, no, can't even go out in the middle of the day. And so we've got to fight back in large numbers. Fight back, I can't make it alone. Fight back in large numbers. Together we can make a safe home. Together we can make a safe home. Women all around the world, every color, religion, and age. But one thing we've got in common, we can all be battered and raped. We can all be battered and raped. And so we've got to fight back in large numbers. A fight back, I can't make it alone. Fight back in large numbers. Together we can make a safe home. Together we can make a safe home. Some have an easy answer, buy a lock and live in a cage. But my fear is turning to anger, and my anger is turning to rage. And I won't live my life in a cage, no. So we gotta fight back in large numbers. A fight back, I can't make it alone. Fight back in large numbers. Together we can make a safe home. Together we can make a safe home. Together we can make a safe home. By day I lived in terror, by night I lived in fright. For as long as I can remember, a lady don't go out alone at night. Fight back, a lady don't go out alone at night. Fight back, a lady don't go out alone at night. Fight back, a lady don't go out alone at night. Fight back.
Of course I had to play that song. How else am I going to do a show on violence against women without playing Holly Near doing Fight Back? I remember a long time ago, about 1980, I saw, I was at a, some sort of political feminist type gathering, and I saw the Brooklyn Women's Martial Arts Union perform a kata, which is a stylized form of fighting to that piece, and it was quite angry and quite lovely. Fight Back by Holly Near from Imagine My Surprise. 6:39, I keep saying 5:39, 5 whatever, I'm an hour off. 6:39 on a Sunday morning. My name is Sharon Griffiths, and you're listening to Heresy. The topic this morning, the sermon of the day, violence against women in practical terms, dealing with it in practical ways, dealing with it by writing out your anger. That, unfortunately, is a large segment of women's literature, feminist literature, lesbian literature, talking about the anger that came from having violence done to themselves or having violence done to a partner or a friend. But I'm going to leave on a, even though this is a miserable topic, it's one of these things where you just kind of have to do it every now and again. I'm also very, very aware and great advocate for domestic violence, social service, relief of domestic violence. I met some incredible women in my work from the Ann Arbor domestic violence project, Safe House. Just intelligent, thought-provoking women. And they turned me on, so to speak, to the issues and sort of turned things around for me as far as like becoming an advocate. This is my area of feminism, violence against women in all forms, but domestic violence in particular. This is a piece by Juana Maria Paz from Sinister Wisdom, again, the publication. It's called From Battered Wife to Community Volunteer, Testimony of a Welfare Mother, and hopefully will leave you on a more positive note concerning what happens to these women and how it is indeed possible to turn your life around. In 1976, my husband began beating me with a frequency and intensity that caused me to fear for my life and that of my 9-month-old baby, Mary Ann. We lived in a small cottage on the Florida coast, and I supported all three of us with my veterans benefits that enabled me to go to college for the first time. In June of that year, Brian admitted some startling things, that he'd made sure he slept with me every day until I got pregnant, and that he'd manipulated me during the entire relationship through an elaborate system of lies and deceptions. He laughed and said it was easy, that I had a moral code that I lived by, and he could always anticipate how I'd react to any situation. He also said he wasn't letting me go alive. I threatened to leave, and he threatened to kill all of us, including the baby and the dog. The night he dragged me around the house, closing windows with one hand to muffle the noise and covered my mouth with another, I knew he was serious. I held the baby with one arm, and with the other I tried to loosen his grip on my mouth so I could breathe. I broke free long enough to scream bloody murder, and the police arrived within minutes, checked me for external injuries, and tried to get me to make a statement, but the inside of my mouth was cut and I couldn't talk. They assured me that my neighbors were looking out for me and urged me to yell if I needed help. They said someone in the neighborhood would hear me and call them. They left and Brian apologized. Actually, he wanted to have sex. I refused and he waited until the next day to rape me. Things went from bad to worse and I made plans to leave town. I was all packed and waiting for a ride to the bus station when he came home drunk and carrying a loaded gun. He held me hostage for 4 hours and slapped me and knocked me down so many times that I can't remember them all. He wanted to kill me, but I think he was afraid to live without me. He raped me until he couldn't get an erection anymore. Mary Ann cried at first, but I closed the door so she couldn't watch, and she sat down in her crib to play her red piano. Brian decided I should cook one more dinner before he killed me, and I ran away from him on the way to the grocery store, despite his promise to shoot me in the back if I made any false moves. He disappeared when I started screaming, and I got to a phone and called the police. Since I looked like a victim from a horror movie by then, and I'd called many times before, they had no trouble believing my story, but they did think I might change my mind later and refuse to press charges. I explained that the only way for me to get out of town alive was for them to keep him in jail overnight. The bus to Los Angeles left once a day, and I had already missed it. I dropped out of school when Brian sabotaged the car. The campus was several miles away and public transportation inadequate, so that was the end of my steady income. I'm a Vietnam-era Navy veteran, and I was going to school under my GI Bill. Brian had quit his job so that he could watch me every minute, and I didn't trust him to stay home with the baby while I went out to work. I tried to get welfare, but I wasn't eligible while Brian lived with me, and he refused to leave. I had to get out of town to save my life, and I had to get to a major city with emergency social services. I chose Los Angeles because it was far away and on the West Coast. I knew how to survive on my own in a big city, but I didn't want to go back to New York. I arrived in L.A. after 3 days on the bus, and I didn't know a soul there. I got on welfare quickly, and again, no one had trouble believing my story. My bruises were starting to get large and purple and yellow, and my face was sore and swollen, too. There I was, a young woman walking around a strange city with a baby, a suitcase, and signs of a recent beating. I guess it was pretty obvious. I know, I've been there. Women on buses and street corners seemed to say to me with their eyes. Wherever I went, people seemed to know I was on the run. I spent 9 months staying home, taking care of the baby, healing, forgetting, remembering, and letting go. Some days I was too upset to leave the house. When I did, I often returned to my roach-infested apartment near MacArthur Park to face a dreaded image of my husband standing in the shadows, red-faced with beer and violence, holding a gun and sneering, "Hello, honey, get undressed." That it could come to this, I thought as I calmed down and assured myself that it was just my old fear welling up inside me and making it seem so real. Surely he never could find us. After all, the police had arrested him. After the better part of a year, I was ready to face the world again. I went to a welfare conference and plunged headlong into welfare rights work. I gave and gave and gave, trying to change a system that basically never budged, though minor concessions were made, and I personally could have become a token minority at a low-paying social service agency job. I stayed on welfare and learned how to cope with people's assumptions about me, mostly that I'm not working and that I'm more dependent on the system than they are. People seem to expect me to feel ashamed of being on welfare, and they thought I would want to keep it as secret as possible. Like when I was a battered wife, I wanted everybody to know, and I wanted them to know how I got there. I made a conscious choice to stay on welfare, especially as I became more employable. Aside from people's attitudes about my supposed inferiority, shame, and dependence, the life is not that bad. I had time to myself, and I had already learned the ins and outs of the welfare department, so I knew I was eligible and how to stay that way. The money wasn't so much, but I'd been buying all of our clothes and household supplies at thrift shops for years anyway, so it didn't really involve a major change in shopping or lifestyle. Also, I was already pretty much a vegetarian, and by eliminating expensive meat and dairy products from our diet and cooking from scratch a lot, I could feed both of us on my food stamp allotment. I basically liked living alone and don't miss having a mate. I never wanted to marry again, although I did despair at the beginning of ever resuming normal relations with men. Then I decided I didn't know what that was and didn't care. I was not afraid to face the world alone and never thought I needed another person to co-parent my child, although a lot of my plans were postponed for years while she was little. When welfare rights became a never-ending cycle of infighting and meetings that went nowhere, I went on to other things. Women's land, school again, feminism, writing lesbianism, and to tie it all together, I began writing regularly for the lesbian feminist publications. I still have to contend with people's judgment and hostility, their resentment that I'm getting easy money or that I'm paid to sit home and be creative because I had a baby, while they have to go out and work for a living. I make a clear choice to forego the social status and higher income of regular employment in favor of the income maintenance and freedom of movement that I now enjoy. Most people who hate me for being on welfare would not want to live the way I do. Until recently, at my daughter's insistence, I had never bought furniture, appliance, or any kind of entertainment equipment such as TV, radio, tape recorders, or whatever. It was fine with me to live without these things, but at 7 years old and in public school, my daughter feels a tremendous pressure to be normal. In fact, I've done such a good job of living within my income that she doesn't seem to know that we're poor people, and she regularly tells people that we have a lot of money. I have to watch that because most of the people who get prosecuted for welfare fraud get turned in by a friend or neighbor. People continually ask me how I manage to stay on welfare and if I really lie about my income. They always seem disappointed when I assure them that I'm completely legal and I report everything. My book business is well documented in my AFDC case, and it doesn't generate enough income to affect the amount of my monthly check. I'm careful about not telling people in the community my business because even though my continued eligibility remains unchanged, any investigation into my case could keep me busy for a long time, basically make my life miserable while I clear myself of all accusations. The hostility and put-downs are constant and subtle, and all of a sudden I'm not so sure of what I want anymore. I think all my early volunteerism was a way of proving myself to be a capable and worthwhile person and to give something back to the taxpayers who support me. In addition to the women's movement where I write for free, I've also been a volunteer at a mental health association, community radio and TV stations, a food cooperative, and I put in hours at a feminist women's health center until they decided volunteerism was oppressive to women and sent me a check for my work. I'm not sure how much appeasing my own sense of guilt and inadequacy for not being a wage earner has actually helped, either myself or the world around me, since pandering to people's hostility about welfare never changes their minds. If anything, the resentment increases both inside and outside the feminist movement as I become more successful and happy and learn to use my welfare income to promote my career as a writer and media personality. I've accomplished enough now that I do not have to keep providing myself again and again, and I want to be more clear and focused in my goals and activities instead of just keeping busy for the sake of being active. I still want to work to make the world a better place, but now I want my own goals to be a priority, and I think it's okay if there's something in it for me, too, when I give my time and energy. One of the biggest obstacles to achieving my full potential is people's continued presumption that I am not working and that my time is available, or that I should work for them for free or just generally let them waste my time. I should make it clear that these responses and presumptions are just as strong and hateful within the New Age counterculture and the women's movement as in what can be called mainstream America. I have enough plans and ambitions to last a lifetime if I don't let other people's attitudes undermine my enthusiasm and my will to achieve, but it's a constant struggle. Usually it's easier not to discuss welfare with anyone, especially white people who hate me for so many things anyway. It's alarming sometimes to think about how many minority groups I belong to and what that means, since it takes enormous energy and inner strength to overcome both the external obstacles and my own fears. I spend a lot of time just working on myself, coming down from the last episode and preparing for the next idea or goal, and I think I've come farther in order to be where I am than people who don't carry the following labels. I'm a woman, I'm single, Puerto Rican, I have no college degree, I'm a veteran, a single parent, a lesbian, on welfare, a vegetarian, and a kind of counterculture progressive type. I've eaten organic food for years, and I make and wear my own flowing matriarchal costumes. Also, I'm more downwardly mobile in terms of lifestyle and upwardly mobile in terms of accomplishments and work. Some days it's just too much, and I don't want to face the outside world. That's why it's important for me to live alone with just Marianne so I don't have to. When I can't take it anymore, I just go home and lock the door. With no phone, I'm pretty inaccessible, and I discourage visits from all but the best of friends, those people who don't put undue pressure on me. As far as the broad assumption that I am more dependent on the system than someone with a job, I can only contend that I feel freer now than I did when I was being controlled by a boss, a husband, a university, and even the feminist movement. Keeping the welfare trip together gives me a lot of leverage in dealing with the rest of the world. If my books don't sell, I don't have to worry about how to pay the rent. And if the people I work with on a volunteer basis don't like my performance, they can't withhold a paycheck. I would never want to be financially dependent on a husband or lover again. In a way, being on welfare has given me the freedom to be a totally independent artist and also to stay celibate as long as I want. I acknowledge the fact that white lovers, male or female, usually represent an opportunity to increase my access to money or privilege, and in that way I always depend on the relationship to make my life easier, whether that capability is realized or not. I've opted out of the whole lover game by concentrating on myself and my own process and progress. I no longer ask for those things that are mine by right: respect, freedom of choice, privacy, tolerance, and understanding. I'm not sure I believe in mass re-education anymore. I think misjudgment and ignorance are deliberate excuses that people use to get what they want at other people's expense. The people who value my work and myself seem capable of doing that without long involved explanations. So if I've stopped qualifying my life as well as my statements, then I'm less likely to let myself get put on the defensive by someone else's accusations or desire to monopolize my time. Although more opportunities exist for me in the feminist movement than anywhere else, I'm not sure it has all the answers either, since mistrust and malevolence continue to divide women and keep us from realizing the full extent of our power together. As people take their freedom in all walks of life, I believe the answer for all of us lies in the ability to increase our own and each other's choices. I don't think the energy expended in hating people like me with my $116 per month welfare check is helping anyone in that kind of jealous anger resentment. That kind of jealous anger resentment is something that women continue to undermine each other with. It's time we started applauding each other's freedoms, choices, and movement in many different directions. That was a piece called From Battered Wife to Community Volunteer: Testimony of a Welfare Mother, by Juana Maria Paz, from a publication called Sinister Wisdom, which is available at a wonderful bookstore named Judith's Room, which is at 681 Washington Avenue. I promised I was going to get that information for you guys last week. I remember the address, but I didn't bring the business card, so I don't have the phone number. But it's in Manhattan, and you can call Manhattan Information for Judith's Room. A very great bookstore that sells the women's periodicals, women's books, stuff that's out of print, so that you could have a craving to get this book that you maybe saw once a long time ago. And it just might be there, which is just lovely. It's a good place, and they've been there for 2 years, and they have readings on Thursday nights at 7, and they're just a good community kind of place to be. It's way, way over on Washington Street, which is very, very, very far west village. I'm almost out of here at 6:56 on a Sunday morning. You've been listening to Heresy. My name is Sharon Griffiths. I'll be back in 2 weeks, which will take me into July. And during July and August, I'm doing potpourri shows, mainly because I couldn't think that far ahead when I was submitting folio copy. So you just don't know what you'll be tuning in for, but you will be hearing women's fiction, women's music, women's poetry in probably no set topics unless I come up with something. If you'd like a playlist of the records I play, of the pieces I read, you can write in for that. I'd also love to hear from you by way of postcard, by way of letter. And I'm at 505 8th Avenue, New York, 10018. This is WBAI. My name is Sharon, Sharon, Griffiths, Griffiths. And the name of the show is Heresy, Heresy. Be back in 2 weeks. Next week, I believe, is a program called My Emotion. The week after that, Cosmic Debris with Rocky and Pandora, and they always do good stuff. So until then, be talking to you. Bye-bye.
You've got your dial set to 99.5 FM WBAI in New York. The time is 7 a.m. Through the Opera Glass is a weekly feature of this station. Today's host is Tony Koji and Regina Sokol. And now, Through the Opera Glass with Tony and Regina.
But if I want to communicate with another, shouldn't I be responsible enough to seem blameless? How could you possibly explain the time Sylvia Plath was shampooing her hair and turned around to give you her own diamond collar, a flat, glittering necklace that was really faceted from ice, as you realized once you fastened its freezing beauty around your throat? It began to melt, didn't it? Or how could you possibly communicate the knot of tiny scum-brown worms all writhing around the unseeable yellow sunflower at the center? How can you clarify the moment when you and your husband kissed, and there was blood on the lips of each of you, but neither could tell whose blood it was? Will footnotes help you there? Oh, my God, I'd forgotten those. The time he tried to commit you to an asylum. The time you tried to plunge a sword into his heart? or for that matter, the time his body streamed with light, the time he floated easily beyond the tidal wave you feared, smiling beneficently and calling for you to join him in the lagoon behind the storm? The time you ignored a hothouse of blazing tiger lilies and yellow iris and insisted on entering the flower arranging competition instead with an arrangement of a single withering black tulip surrounded by four stalks of wheat? You were well aware that so bizarre an entry didn't stand a chance of winning, but you were defiant, saying, "Bright flowers all wither, too, and come to the same end. But a black tulip, even a dying black tulip, is very rare." I watched you after you'd convinced yourself you'd woken up from that one. I watched you analyze the black tulip as your love for him.
Wasn't it?
I thought... I know what you thought. It would be nice if, for a change, you knew what I thought. Well, was it? You know as well as I do, of course. But I rather assumed the black tulip was your own pride in the negativity of your love for him.
Pride in my negativity? Why on earth would I feel that?
Hasn't it won you gold stars on the Women's Movement chart of approval? Didn't you, for a while there, shift from wanting to be blameless where he was concerned to wanting to be blameless where other feminists were concerned?
Now, wait a minute. That's terribly unfair. I mean, yes, I shifted, something like you say, but that's not the whole story. For one thing, I have felt deeply, truly negative about him sometimes. Hating, despairing, so filled with pain of him that I had no idea who I myself was or might be. You know that better than I do. It was you who showed me the handmaiden of the holy man. It was you who breathed him out as a tornado that shook the whole house while I carried our naked, sleeping child out to the street, fighting the gusts with every muscle and tendon in my body. It was you who had me refuse to stop him from committing suicide by jumping out of the speeding car. For that matter, it was only in your presence that he kept turning into my mother.
Do restrain yourself, dear, from all this accusation. It was you, it was you. As if you and I were separate. It's tedious and unworthy of us.
But that's not all. There was the light. There was the lagoon. I've also felt more love for him, more recognition, more love and recognition from him, more soul twining, if I can call it that, with him, than with any other human being, with the possible exception of our child, which is different anyway. Besides, you blithely overlook another area where something sure as metaphor is going on. It hasn't all been groveling approval-seeking from other women. Remember when you helped me fight a whole collective of hardline Central Committee-type women who had kidnapped the child because they wanted to save me from the oppression of having born a male child? Remember all the dreams about the special one woman I loved more than any other woman and who I thought loved me? Remember when she twisted my arm in a restaurant so hard that she broke it? Remember when she got married in a subway car and rejected me as matron of honor, and I sat there mortified and hurt while the ceremony proceeded, reading a subway advertisement that bore a photo of me with the caption ex-child star and generally useful?
I think we were trying to tell you something, don't you?
Damned right we were. But was I listening? Oh, no. No, Senoy, me, this cookie.
Look, you needn't leap from self-defense to self-contempt. You might pause for a moment at self-knowledge.
Self-knowledge isn't always that available or even desirable when you wake up with your skin drenched in sweat and your heart pounding, when you find during certain periods that you're actually afraid to fall asleep at night. You needn't come on so all pure and all helpful. What about the victims of shell shock, of rape, of the concentration camps? What about the torture they endured, dreaming and redreaming the same moment of worst atrocity, night after night, sometimes for the rest of their lives? Is that kind of you and your kind? Is that merciful?
Perhaps not kind, no, but strangely merciful. There are things worse than remembering. To forget such an experience can be to remain in its thrall forever. To remember may be the only way of surviving it, exorcising it,
Besides, you really can't keep splitting things up the way you do. There is a collaboration between the dreamer and the dream, you know. Dream better dreams, Mark Twain warned. I'm only the medium. Furthermore, who are you to complain? You haven't had it so bad. It hasn't been all nightmares now, has it? I distinctly recall you being a Hawaiian priestess, dancing ecstatically in your own body, lithe and oiled to a glistening patina, dancing with careless confidence around the mouth of a volcano. Laurence Olivier was watching, I think, or Dirk Bogarde, I forget which. But you took no notice, so given over were you to the dance.
Yes. Oh, and the wonderful journey we took inside our body, remember? When we showed me all the delicate mechanisms, the exquisite poise of the weights and balances, the way the blood rushes through the arteries like garnet rapids. I remember how the lymph looked like a film of milky crystal. I remember the irrepressible, indomitable, slow drum beat echo of my heart reverberating along each bone. Oh, and that wonderfully erotic...